Welcome, and let's first talk compliance. I'm Catherine Short, Partnership Marketing Manager at First Healthcare Compliance. Thanks for tuning in. This show is brought to you by First Healthcare Compliance as part of our commitment to provide high-quality complementary educational resources. We help create confidence among compliance professionals throughout the United States. Please show your support by taking a moment to provide a review on Google, Facebook, or iTunes. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. On today's episode, we are speaking with Jennifer Gimler Brady, partner at Potter, Anderson, and Caroon LLP, about OSHA's COVID-19 safety guidance and other important considerations for safely returning employees to the workplace. On January 29th, 2021, OSHA issued new guidance for COVID-19 workplace safety programs. Among others, the guidance recommends several essential elements of an effective COVID prevention program. We will discuss the OSHA guidance as well as other important considerations that employers take into account when planning for returning employees to the workplace, including the pros and cons of mandatory COVID vaccines. Before we begin, I would like to mention at First Healthcare Compliance, we strive to serve as a trusted resource for compliance professionals. And every month, we celebrate their hard work and dedication with our Compliance Super Ninja recognition. For this episode, we're spotlighting Super Ninja Marianne Johnson, practice manager at Clinic by the Sea, who says she enjoys most about working there is that cardiology is so interesting and the patients make it worth our while. The owner of our company, George Dar, MD, is a great cardiologist, and I am impressed how much compassion he has with his patients and staff. All of our providers are great, and it is a good feeling watching the patient interaction with my staff and our providers. Congratulations, Marianne. Our team is honored to have the privilege of working with you. So, Jennifer, it is wonderful to have you here with us today on First Talk Compliance, discussing these newly updated regulations and what this means for our listeners.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Catherine. Thank you.
Thank you. So, is OSHA inspecting or auditing workplaces for COVID-19 safety?
Well, OSHA has broad authority over workplace safety issues, and essentially, employers are required to provide safe and healthful environments for their employees. And we typically think about the OSHA jurisdiction in terms of maybe heavy construction or when there's a major industrial accident, we think about OSHA. We think about it maybe less so in the public health space with a public health emergency like we've had with COVID. But it certainly falls within OSHA's jurisdiction to ensure that workplaces are providing safe and healthy environments for their employees to the extent that employees are back in particular work environments. Some employees never left, some essential workers. Many employers have been gradually bringing employees back into the workplace. And they're in doing so, they're required to ensure that those workplaces are safe for their employees. And so the jurisdiction of OSHA extends to inspecting or auditing workplaces to ensure that they are, in fact, complying with OSHA regulations and overarching safety considerations. Typically, OSHA doesn't just do a random type of inspection, although they certainly have in the past, and they've looked at particular industries and have done inspections of like employers within particular industries. With COVID, many of the inspections that they're doing are in response to complaints that they've received, generally from employees or former employees of those work environments who have voiced concerns about safety, whether it's the lack of availability of personal protective equipment or inadequate personal protective equipment, whether it's not providing an environment that's conducive to social distancing, not enforcing mask wearing and other PPE wearing, not honoring and enforcing sanitation protocols. Those are types of things that have been reported for various complaint forms. And so OSHA may, not always, but may conduct an on-site investigation to see firsthand whether or not safety protocols are being followed.
If OSHA does come in, what can OSHA do if it determines that a workplace is unsafe in terms of COVID protections?
Well, OSHA has a variety of enforcement tools in their arsenal. Perhaps the one that we see most often is penalties, financial penalties. Often, it really depends on what is found during the survey and inspection. If there's a good faith effort by the employer to comply, to provide a safe work environment, but maybe it's not as either up to speed on best practices as it should be, or there are gaps in their safety protocols, OSHA might take a more educational approach to dealing with that particular workplace and may not be in penalty mode. However, if there are serious concerns about the employer's commitment to a safe environment and basic safety protocols are not in place, those are the circumstances where you're more likely to see financial penalties. Those penalties, again, depending on the nature of the employer and whether it's a large employer or a small employer, what its revenues look like. To some businesses, their penalties, the penalties imposed by OSHA can seem extraordinary and significant. In other businesses, they might be viewed as more of a cost of doing business. During the pandemic, OSHA has been criticized in some circles for not being aggressive enough about being on site and seeing what was happening in businesses, particularly businesses that remained open and had workers coming in the early days of the pandemic. There was a lot of criticism of OSHA for being, seen but not heard. And over time, I think that feedback made its way and resonated with OSHA, and they certainly stepped up their inspections and enforcement activity. In general, I would say that the penalties typically, if there's an average amount, looking at the COVID-specific inspection and penalties, might be an average of $15,000 to $17,000. The penalties have ranged from, in the $5,000 range up to around $30,000. And again, depending on the nature of your business and how thin your margins are, et cetera, you may view that penalty as significant, or it may not be as consequential, but it may also be an effort to send messages. Because, of course, if there are penalties and it becomes public and you have worker injuries down the road, or if you're, say, a residential setting, and you have patients who have injuries down the road, it's not much of a stretch to argue that a lax safety culture that is reflected in an OSHA inspection and a penalty contributed to the injuries or damages that someone had experienced. So even if the fine itself may not be viewed as significant, there still are potential consequences and negative consequences.
Can employers require employees to get a COVID-19 vaccination?
Excellent question. One that is not necessarily susceptible to a yes or no answer. I would start out by saying that in general, employers can require employees to get vaccinations as an employment matter. The EEOC has said it is okay, particularly if you are in a business where there is a compelling safety issue, a compelling health, or perhaps a direct threat to the health and well-being of the workplace. this issue's come up previously in workplaces where, and again, particularly in healthcare, where employers have required employees to get flu vaccinations, both to maintain the health and well-being of employees, but in particular because they're caring for individuals in either a long-term care setting or a hospital setting, perhaps, that have compromised, that are medically compromised and vulnerable. They don't want to get the residents or the patients sick with the flu. So in general, the EEOC has said mandatory vaccination policies are permissible, provided that you allow for exceptions that are based on medical reasons or bona fide religious tenet, a part of someone's religious faith that is prohibits acceptance of vaccinations. The medical exemption is somewhat, in some ways, easier to deal with than the religious-based exemption, because in general, if somebody is going to assert a medical reason, they'll have their physician or healthcare provider provide a letter that says simply, you know, based on the employee's condition of diabetes, maybe it's a prior history of vaccine reactions, adverse vaccine reactions. Maybe it's, an underlying medical condition. The physician will write the letter and the employer will honor the employee's exemption based on medical reasons. Religious-based exemptions are a little bit more difficult because you're really putting yourself as an employer, you're in the position of kind of probing the religious beliefs of your employees and whether or not they are bona fide or, frankly, being asserted to simply try to excuse the employee who otherwise just doesn't want to be vaccinated. It's actually a very interesting bit of research to do to delve into religious practices or religious faiths where vaccines are not permitted. It's actually relatively few, and it's a fairly nuanced argument, but you can see how it could put employers in a difficult spot of essentially questioning both the nature of an employee's religious beliefs, testing whether they are actually held by the employee. So some ways that employers may be able to navigate that issue and the kind of proof that an employee may be asked to provide to substantiate that religious belief might be a letter from the leader of the religious practice if the employee goes to an organized religious service of some type. I should note that in order to assert a religious exemption, the employee does not have to be actively engaged in attending services of an organized religion. It can be just a belief system, but the employer can probe whether the employee actually does follow that belief system. And as you can imagine, that puts an employer in a really difficult position to be probing the religious beliefs and of its employees, but also going forward. Because as I often say to my clients, you can't unhear or unlearn certain information that you get in these kinds of processes. And that's similar to a medical-based exemption. Because an employee is coming forward and requesting the exemption, they are now put in a position where they're disclosing information to their employer that they otherwise wouldn't have had to. And the employer, consequently, is now in possession of information that it otherwise wouldn't have known about the employee. So you can perhaps fast forward to maybe a disciplinary situation or, you know, some other job-related issue that has nothing to do with vaccinations, but the employee's unhappy with the outcome and now might be inclined to assert an argument that the real reason that the employer took whatever action or didn't take a desired action is not because of the merits of the decision, but because they know that I practice this religious faith or they know that I have this illness or disability or medical condition. So it does put employers in a tricky position when they mandate a vaccine mandate some type of action like this and then put employees in the position of having to assert an exemption. So that's one of the issues that employers sometimes will think long and hard about before making something mandatory. If you apply that in the COVID world, you certainly can. And there are employers who are considering mandatory vaccination policies. However, there's an additional caveat or consideration with the COVID vaccines, and that is they are authorized by the FDA pursuant to an emergency use authorization or EUA. And there is a school of thought out there that because the vaccines are under a EUA as opposed to a full FDA approval, that making them mandatory for employees is not permissible. And that is premised upon a provision in the statute, the pursuant to which EUAs can be granted, where there's some language saying that with regard to EUA medications, vaccinations, devices, whatever the item is that is subject to the EUA approval, that recipients have the right to decline to receive them and need to be informed of the consequences of that declining vaccine, device, whatever it is, and have to be advised of alternatives. That is right. A classic informed consent.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Talk Compliance, brought to you by First Healthcare Compliance as part of our commitment to provide high-quality complementary educational resources. We help create confidence among compliance professionals throughout the United States. My guest today is Jennifer Gimler-Brady, partner at Potter Anderson Caroon, LLP, about OSHA's COVID-19 safety guidance and other important considerations for safely returning employees to the workplace. Please show your support by taking a few minutes to provide a review of First Healthcare Compliance on Google or Facebook. You can also follow us on other forms of social media. Is an employer required to grant an employee's request for an accommodation to continue working remotely?
If you have an employee who is asking for a medical accommodation, the ability to continue to work from home, the employer needs to engage in an interactive dialogue or an interactive process with the employee to discuss their requested accommodation and for the employer to kind of evaluate how that accommodation fits in with their business. And essentially, as long as the requested accommodation does not impose an undue hardship on the employer should grant the accommodation. And being mindful that granting the accommodation today doesn't necessarily mean that the employee will never return to the workplace. As things improve, and perhaps as we approach herd immunity and the pandemic subsides, the accommodation can be revisited, assuming that there is not some compelling hardship reason why the employer needs to insist that this high-risk individual return to the workplace. That may be an instance where the continuing to work remotely accommodation should be granted. But it's important to note that it is an interactive process. The employer can't just ignore the request or impose some other accommodation. Although I would also say the employer is not required to grant exactly what the employee asks for. There could be an alternative accommodation that accomplishes both the safety interests of the employee and the work interests of the employer. So that's why it's called an interactive process. It's not, I just ask for something and I get it. It's a informed discussion back and forth, hopefully to land on a result that's a win-win for the employee and the employer. At the other end of the spectrum could be an employee who just really enjoys working from home, the flexibility that they have, or maybe they have a long commute that they've enjoyed not having to do. And the employer, there's no medical reason for that in that case. Then the employer needs to look at the employer's policies And the most important thing in that kind of a situation is consistency of decision making. So if you're a flexible employer and you've been happy with the productivity of individuals who are working remotely and it's working for you and it's getting the job done, you may entertain that kind of a request from an employee. But what you want to be mindful of is when you're outside the realm of medical justifications for those types of decisions and you're really looking at other personnel related considerations, that you're making consistent decisions, that you're applying a consistent rationale, so that if I am asking for the ability to continue to work from home, and you say yes, but then my neighbor down, my former office neighbor is asking for the same thing, and we have the same job, and you're saying no to her, you need to have a very clear rationale why we are not treated similarly. That's where, you know, making exceptions or making different decisions based on different criteria could back end you into some type of disparate treatment claim. Ultimately, if you have an employee who just says, I don't want to come back to work, and you've made the decision that you need to be back in the workplace. Again, you try to encourage the employee, you try to educate the employee as much as you can, but ultimately it may come down to an employee, to a decision that the employee is not accepting employment on the terms it's being offered, and it will result in some type of separation.
You talked about incentives in a question earlier. Have there been incentives for the vaccination? Can an employer offer employees cash incentives or other types of incentives to get a COVID-19 vaccination?
The answer to both of those questions is yes. The employers can, and yes, employers are offering incentives. There, you know, are considerations with that, though. First of all, again, when we've talked about the scenario of people who are not able to get the vaccine for medical reasons or for religious reasons, you have to be mindful of the impact on those individuals. If, say, you're offering everybody a day off with pay if they get the vaccine, and you've got folks who are medically unable or based on their religious beliefs are unable, they're not eligible for that benefit. So you can easily see how you could turn that into a disparate impact type of argument, that you're disadvantaging people because of their religious beliefs or their medical status. So the careful guidance would be offering de minimis incentives. By that, I mean, you know, maybe a branded water bottle or a small value gift card. One thing I've seen employers do is offer paid time off for the time it's taken somebody to go and get vaccinated, if they have to go to an offsite clinic to get the vaccination and they're going to be gone for a couple of hours, to pay them so they're not sustaining a wage loss to do that. But I will tell you, other employers, I have seen other employers give, you know, cash incentives to try to encourage vaccination, to give, some have considered a vacation day, adding to a vacation day to their allotment. But I think employers just need to be mindful of also the ethical issue of, you know, it's been characterized as bribing employees to get vaccinated, and whether that idea fits within their structure and their view of what's right and what's appropriate. But most definitely, employers who are not wanting to go down the mandatory road, but are looking at trying to encourage people to the fullest extent possible, are absolutely considering various incentives to try to encourage employees to get vaccinated.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer. This has been very enlightening.
My pleasure.
And I wanted to thank our audience for tuning in to First Talk Compliance. You can learn more about our show on the programs page on healthcarenowradio.com. And lend your voice to the conversation on Twitter at FirstHCC or hashtag FirstTalkCompliance. You can also email me at KatherineShort@FirstHCC.com. I'm Katherine Short of First Healthcare Compliance. Remember, compliance is the key to achieving peace of mind.